It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Jess Phillips, and welcome back to Yours Sincerely. Now, most of you might know I'm an MP in Birmingham, but what you might not know is that I've always been a prolific letter writer and know the power of putting words to paper. So in this podcast, I give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Terry White is an author and journalist who's worked as the editor of Empire Magazine and Time Out New York. She's had an incredibly successful career, but she began her life with a painful and traumatic childhood that's since driven her to campaign for victims of abuse as the NSPCC's campaigner for childhood. In her new podcast series for BBC Radio 5 Live and BBC Sounds, Terry returns to her hometown of Chesterfield to find out how 100,000 children dropped off England's school registers in lockdown, why so many children are still missing from education, and how to reach those who are enduring the same kind of difficult upbringing she survived. Today, I'm excited to talk to her about the letters she would send to three people who mean the world to her. Hello, Terry. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is all about letter writing, this podcast. Are you much of a letter writer? You are of the right generation. I hate to divide the people who come on this podcast between those who are under 30 and those who are over 30. But the people who are under 30 have never written a letter in their lives, it seems. And the people who are over 30 were all in, like, you know, the Smash Hits fan club.
Funny you should say that, because I was in the Take That fan club.
Oh, were you?
And I used to write letters to the other members, and we'd all call each other by the surname of whoever we fancied. So I was Mrs. Terry Owen.
Oh, but surely everybody was Owen. Didn't everybody fancy Mark Owen?
Well, there was a lot of competition and a lot of jealousy, so we kind of all deliberately made friends with girls who liked the other guys.
Oh, I see.
Otherwise, it was just too much.
Because the likelihood was that you were going to end up marrying them, so you didn't want to fall out with your friends.
Quite. And I did. I wrote Mark Owen a letter. I interviewed him, like, years later, but I wrote him a letter detailing in lots and lots and lots of excruciating detail exactly why we were meant to be and we were going to spend the rest of our lives together.
Did he respond?
Did he fuck?
Oh, Mark Owen, now's your chance to respond. Get a letter to Terry. How rude.
I know.
Imagine how many letters they must have got.
Oh, my God. And it was stuff like, we're both quite shy. We both like dolphins, because he had a dolphin tattoo.
He had a dolphin tattoo out of his belly.
Yeah.
I remember it like it was yesterday.
Oh, God.
I remember Katie Wakeman, shout out to Katie Wakeman, at my school, who, on the day that Take That broke up, honestly, I actually think they did put, like, Samaritans lines on, at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking, my main takeaway from it was they should have made Never Forget their last song, What Were You Thinking? That second, you know, the Bee Gees cover
How
that came
deep is
after.
Your love?
I mean, rubbish.
No.
I sat next to Jason Orange at a play. There was a girl who was going out with him at my university, and
oh
she put
God.
On a play, and I don't remember a single thing about the play, because me and my friend Helen just sat there staring at Jason Orange the whole time.
When I interviewed Mark Owen, I was like, I can't tell him that I used to be a psychotic fan. And I also can't tell him that I sat outside his house once, just on the off chance that he came home, even though I think he was on a world tour at the time. I interviewed him when I was a young journalist, and it was still the most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done in my life. And I've interviewed, you know, like directors and A-list Hollywood actresses. Mark Owen, I may have had a small drink of alcohol before I interviewed him.
The only time I have been totally like, I'll regret this for the rest of my life. When I met Keanu Reeves, he was in Parliament. I don't know, doing something about the environment, and I like a magnet, I just walked up to him, and I had literally nothing to say. It's horrendous.
Did you just say his name, like, Keanu Reeves?
Oh, hello, Keanu Reeves. Yeah, like. Your Bill. You're Ted, actually. Yeah, sorry, I apologise. Yeah. You're in Point Break, the greatest film ever made, ever. I was not cool about it. So I can imagine. But now, we all fancied Mark Owen. Yeah. So, you know, fair play. But it turns out that Howard and Jason were the hotties. As I've got older, I realise now.
Yeah, it's always interesting who ages better, doesn't and Gary Barlow, to be fair.
I mean, who saw that coming? I mean, literally nobody.
No dad bod on him, is there? He's like turned him centre out. There's nothing wrong with him in the first place, I should probably hasten to add, apart from he has definitely improved with age.
And his hair definitely has got better.
Oh my God.
He had that terrible sort of spiky hair that everybody had in the late 80s.
What, that white peroxide? So when they did that, their first song, and that
could
video.
It be magic? Was it?
Can you remember the video with the jelly?
One. Oh yeah, the jelly one.
On their bare bums. Any young people, go and Google this. And he had that peroxide.
Spiky
white hair.
Yeah.
Not a good look.
Not a good look, Gary. You definitely look better now.
You'll be pleased to hear we've decided.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Gary Barlow, you're all right. So you sent a lot of letters to a lot of take that-ers?
Basically.
But they never wrote back to you, take
never
that.
Wrote back
rude,
to me.
Rude,
never wrote back
rude.
To me. And I sent him some beads. So
and he always wore beads.
He always wore beads. So I sent him some beads. And I remember vividly, I'd walk home. When I got to my house, you'd go up some steps and you'd be able to see the mantelpiece through the window when you got to the top step. And every day after school, I'd get to the top step just desperate to see a letter on the mantelpiece.
Oh, yeah, because you used to be able to see where your letters would come.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. Now you don't get letters, do you, anymore?
No.
I don't really get letters, just things saying you've missed a parcel,
even
though you were in. That is that feeling of, like, maybe it'll be there when I get home.
And it never was.
Yeah. I'd like to apologise to all the people who aren't the exact same age as me and Terry listening to this podcast. I often find that people who are the same age as me, we just end up, like, just talking about the early 1990s. So do you have any letters that you've kept forever, like letters of note from somebody like fancy and or like getting a job for the first time or something?
Do you know what I always kept? I kept all the letters my nana wrote me. So when I was at university, my nana used to write to me every week. And I also kept the very first letter I got accepting me for an internship at Marie Claire magazine.
Oh, wow.
Which I wrote to all the magazines in my second year at university. Asking to do an internship for the summer. And the only people who got back to me were Marie Claire, and they offered me, I'll say internship, it was work experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't called internships then either.
Yeah, that language didn't exist.
This
was work
like
experience.
1998. Yeah. I went and did that work experience, and then I worked in magazines for 20 years. So
does Marie Claire still exist?
Yes, it does, but it's online.
Online.
And it was like that. That was kind of the letter that I always felt like changed everything for me.
Yeah.
I remember when it came. I mean, the work experience, I should just point out, wasn't even really on the magazine. They allowed me to do work experience on the receptionist desk.
But still, you can write
still,
it on your CV,
exactly,
can't you? Still
exactly.
Something. Still
but,
something.
But then tragedy struck because when I moved back from New York, a big box of my belongings got lost somewhere over the sea. And in that box was, I kept a box of letters, all the letters, important letters I'd ever got in my life from, like, my first boyfriend and jobs and all of that. All gone, forever. Lost.
Oh, no, and you've never found it. It's somewhere.
Yeah, God knows where.
When I was a kid, I used to think it would be good if you could get the thing you lost to make it glow so that you could find it like a beacon. I thought that, like, you know, by now somebody would have invented that. But
isn't that fine? It's a bit like find. You had find my iPhone.
I invented find my phone. I'd also like to say for the listener, I also invented Gogglebox. I definitely invented that before they did. Like, yeah, me and my friend Alex were convinced that we invented Gogglebox. I mean, we didn't tell anyone, so, like, you know, somebody else came up with the idea, but we definitely invented Gogglebox. What we invented was, you know, the dawn of the red button, which now you only use when the Olympics is on.
Yep.
The dawn of the red button. Mind you, maybe it's going to get a real... Because who knew QR codes were going to become a thing again? I didn't see that coming.
No.
Until the old Panny D. That you pressed the red button and you could watch, like, other people, like, watching the telly or listen to the commentary of people. Because I used to think that I don't like watching... There's loads of telly I only like to watch when my husband's there because his disdain for it makes it very, very amusing. And I thought this would definitely be enhanced if I could watch people watching it. But and then I was thinking you could, like, localise it so you could watch your neighbours watching it. Yeah, I mean, my neighbours, like, might not agree to it.
Half Big Brother, half Gogglebox, very creepy.
Yeah, it's a bit creepy.
A massive invasion of privacy.
Well, you know, I think we're all letting people invade our privacy all the time now. Yeah. Might as well just go for it. So, I mean, I'm glad to hear that you're a letter fanatic of old. And, Mark Owen, I'm expecting you to write a letter now back to Terry with a fulsome apology for not responding sooner and then to marry her immediately. I assume that's what you're still after.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I know you've got a wife and kids, and I've technically got a boyfriend and a child, but you know, life's for living.
Logistics can be overcome. So I have asked you to think about three different people you would want to write a letter to. So the first one is the person who means the world to you. So who would that be?
So this would be my son. Oh, God, I hate...
That's nice.
Did you hear I had to follow it up then with, like, something just to balance out how cheesy this is? To my three-year-old son, Emlyn.
OK. Oh, Emlyn's a good name. Yeah. When we were kids, it was the name of one of the people on Question Sport.
So
Emlyn Hughes.
So everyone goes to me, oh, my God, is he named after Emlyn Hughes? I'm like, no, he's not named after Emlyn Hughes.
She named him Bill Beaumont. He was also on Question Sport in the 1980s.
Oh, my God, I swear
to God. I feel like
God.
These are very niche references now.
They are, but, yeah, no, definitely not. I don't even really like the name Emlyn. I've got to be honest. But me and my boyfriend couldn't agree. I came up with, like, a list of 100 names.
Yeah, we did that.
And he said no to all of them. And then went, what about Emlyn? And I went... Whatever, like, sure.
I feel like my son, by proxy, was just named by my husband. Because my husband handed me to him after 24 hours of labour and said, it's Harry. And I was like, I'm not sure we settled on that. But once he'd said it... It was done then. Yeah. I was like, OK.
That'd be really brutal in that moment.
Yeah,
No, it isn't. Way to ruin one of the most beautiful moments of his life.
It's like, yeah, we never agreed on that, actually. But so your son, and he's 3 years old, like him. Okay.
He's really cool. He's a proper magical little person. Like, I was like, what if I have a kid and he's like a dick?
Dull, yeah. Right? Dull or a dick, yeah.
Yeah. So my biggest
He must
fear...
be a dick some of the time.
I'm
just to speak up for all children who are... You know, my husband believes that all children are born like a sort of big sausage and they are complete twat when they're born and you spend your entire life just salami slicing the twat away from them until they are functioning adults who can show empathy.
That's a pretty good way, actually, to a slightly dark way of looking at it. But I can see his argument. I can see his argument. But he is, and I've never really been a big fan of kids, like other people's kids. Yeah. And I was like, what if I don't like him? But he's, like, properly sound. He's really funny. He's really clever, really passionate. He's been obsessed with the drums since he was, like, 18 months old.
Brilliant.
And he's just the best company. And I, for years, didn't think I would have kids. I was like, definitely not having kids, mainly because my own parents were so dreadful. I was like, there has to be... Some of that has to have stuck to me. Yeah. Like, that has to be within my genes somewhere.
That you would be a terrible
that
parent.
I'd be a terrible parent. And also, not even just a bad parent, I was, like, convinced I would become evil. I was like, as soon as I become pregnant, this darkness in me is going to, like, erupt and I'm going to become, like,
there is a definite thing where you think something might happen to you when you're pregnant that, like, it opens some sort of black flower in your heart.
100%.
Yeah, and that... You won't love them when they come, and all sorts of fears that
It's a sort of horrible fairy tale world that we seem to think that we exist in real life.
I mean, pregnancy is way more like a horror film than, you know, all the beautiful, like, wonderful things, and also massively like a horror. It's basically like Alien.
I would give birth to, you know, it doesn't bother me. They're giving birth. Being pregnant is the shittest.
It's just, it's just that weird thing of, like, A, you're incubating another human being and growing them. But the way you're taken over and the sense of, you know, there's a massive amount of control in it, but also the sense that this thing is happening inside you that, you know, it is a parasite, isn't it?
It's a parasite.
No offence, Emlyn.
My children continue to be parasites. I literally had to send one of them a tenner moments before you walked in to do this podcast. And once the bank got in touch with me to say, we think that you're being defrauded because you've made this payment three times today. And I thought, yeah, I know.
Oh.
I know. I don't need your judgment. Thank you, HSBC. I know that this is a parasitic relationship of financial abuse that I have with my children. So, yeah, it doesn't end.
No. And I'm always thinking, are we still in the honeymoon bit, right? Because he's three. Mm. So you've got the baby phase.
I think that's hard.
Yeah, that everyone keeps saying. That's,
so if you
this
really
is the
like
bit.
Him,
yeah.
It's only going to get better.
I mean, it's exhausted. Like, I haven't slept through the night in 3 years.
Yeah, that's exhausting.
And it is completely exhausting.
If you really like his company now, that's a good thing, because I will be honest with you, I really loved my kids. I really... And when they're three, they are, like, their personality's starting to really, like, shine through, and that is good. But I have to say, I did find their company quite tedious quite a lot of the time. They're quite repetitive, aren't they? My husband definitely enjoyed their company much more. And now, as teenagers, I much prefer their company.
Yeah.
And much more so than he does. He finds them much more tedious now. But it's good if you like his personality now. And he's already likes drumming. Often on this podcast, I have to talk about my son drumming, because I used to do it from my home, and it was always being recorded on the same day as my son's drum lesson.
Oh.
So I was obviously sorry that you could hear drumming in the background, but that's cool. I love a drumming kid.
Yeah, my boyfriend gave him drumsticks when he was a baby, when we were weaning him, actually, and he just started to click them together, and he's kind of just taught himself, so he's obsessed with Arctic Monkeys was the first one he was obsessed with. Then Oasis. Then now we're on a massive Beatles.
The Who phase. It's good that they go through that. Yeah.
And he basically teaches himself. I'm trying to find him a teacher, but they keep saying he's too young.
He's too little.
But he's upset. So from the moment he wakes up till when he goes to bed, and I'm like pulling them out of his hands. I mean, obviously it's driving us mental.
I mean,
as well.
Yeah, that is like that would drive you mental. But really, like, lean into it. My son is, funnily enough, tomorrow doing an audition to go to a special school that is for music because he loves the drums so much. But they're like, bring your instrument. I was like, that. Can you ring them and say yours is the drums, and you're not taking it on the bus? You can take a whole drum kit on the bus. They have assured us that you don't need to take the drums. And you didn't think you were ever going to have kids?
No, and it was. Do you know what it was? And my friend Sally has spoken about this, who I think you've had on before, Sally Hughes. And her and I talked at one point about me having kids, and she always speaks really powerfully on breaking the cycle.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like.
Yeah, she had a tough time as well, didn't she, in childhood?
And she's got great, great kids, and she's a brilliant mum and human being.
Her kids are the same age as my children. They're exactly the same age, yeah.
And, you know, breaking the cycle was something that I was really concerned about, like, because maybe you're kind of fated to keep repeating the same mistakes. That's how generational trauma works. That's how, you know, families work mainly. So it's kind of astonishing to me that I'm a really good mum.
Well done for saying it, because, like, society is constantly telling you you're a terrible mum. Yeah. Not you personally, just one.
Yeah.
So well done for saying I'm a good mum. I'm good enough. That's what I always say. I am good enough. And if you've got one good parent, I think you're dreaming, because obviously you had neither.
No.
Your child has got a bounty.
Well, and I always say, having one shit parent is bad luck, but having two, it's like, what is it about me that attracts the bad parents? But I was determined. I was like, he is it's not about, like, you know, money or anything like that. It's about I've always wanted him to feel complete safety with us. I never want him to be afraid of us. I never want him to feel fear in our house. I never, ever want him not to feel like we're home for him. And my boyfriend's an amazing dad. His mum and dad are the best grandparents, which is good because he hasn't got any others to rely on. And it's...
How do you feel about that? Because I have to say that makes a massive, massive difference to my experience of being a mum. My mum died when my youngest was three. And I think back and I think I just don't know how I would have done it without her. Just like, not even like that she, you know, the practical help and all that is really helpful, but just like the being somebody who has to tolerate your madness and understands what you're going through and just sort of loves you unconditionally. It must have been incredibly hard to have a newborn baby and not have anyone to have that relationship with.
But, you know, I'd never had that with my mum, really. Yeah. So it wasn't something I'd kind of come to rely on. And I'd always been very independent and very self-reliant, mainly because I kind of had to be.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky in that my mother-in-law... is Norma, shout out to Norma, is just the greatest human being. And she really stepped in and, you know, and everyone loves slagging off the mother-in-law, don't they? She is like, she's one of the best people on earth. And do you know what? She stepped in, like, he was born little in the pandemic. Well, 3 weeks before the pandemic.
Oh, man alive.
Yeah, 3 weeks before the first lockdown. And he was really small and we had to take him to the clinic every week to be weighed, and all the streets were empty. There were no planes, there were no traffic. We had to walk straight there and walk back. And I remember once we'd been and he'd lost a bit more weight than he was meant to. And I immediately rang her and she comforted me and we talked about it. And
they don't tell you that your baby goes on a diet after it's born.
Yeah.
I don't know why they don't mention this, but like it's anyone who's ever thinking of having a baby who doesn't already have one, is that for some reason that babies go on a diet immediately after they're born, drop loads of weight, and you feel like something, especially when you're physically meant to be feeding them with your own body, that you are an enormous failure.
Yes.
And what you need is a Norma in this situation to say, have a word with yourself. It's your baby's going to be fine.
Yeah.
You trust yourself. But it's hard. It's hard. I mean, that's basically what my mum did to me. She just told me I was being a div.
Yeah.
99% of the time.
Yeah.
I needed somebody to tell me I was being a div.
But I'd never had that before. And it was that phone call. I remember, the fact I'd had somebody to ring and that I'd done it. And, you know, she's been amazing. I don't know how I'd have done it without her, to be honest. And still, you know, I'm here talking to you today because she's
looking
back at home looking after my son. So that's been another massive part of having a kid, is this family that suddenly erupts around you.
Yeah.
It's made me much more kind of, much more warm about family.
Yeah.
I've got a brilliant relationship with my brother and sister, but to see our family grow bigger and bring brilliant people into it, all because basically I met a bloke and fell pregnant. Didn't fall pregnant.
I was just saying that.
I accidentally tripped on his spear, and then the next thing you know...
The old term you caught.
Yeah, caught.
I don't know how this happened. Like, I wasn't accidentally caught, although both my pregnancies were an accident.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're the best ones, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and here's the thing. I wouldn't have consciously chosen to have a baby. But when I fell pregnant, I just knew that I wanted to keep the baby. I knew that I could be... I knew instantly that I could and would be a good mum. And at that point, it was like...
Life I've seen the lines on a pregnancy test, I knew exactly what I was going to do in the second that I saw them.
Yep.
And those decisions were different on each and every time, but every single time. I mean, obviously, I pretended each and every time to be, like, mulling it over. I wasn't. I knew exactly what I was going to do the second.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing that sort of like, now I'm going to do this. It's going to be good. I'm going to be able to do it. And no, I'm not going to do this. It's absolutely not the right thing right now. I think that, I mean, he one day will be, I'm sure, be incredibly proud of you. But at the moment, I'm really looking forward to that. I've got an 18-year-old son and he's yet to show any signs of noticing to be proud of me. But
I'm sure he is.
On the sly.
Yeah.
He's proud of being able to ask me for a tenner every 15 seconds. I think when your kids have their own kids, they reflect on how difficult it is, and especially difficult under the circumstances that you grew up with. I imagine he'll think you're pretty damn cool.
Well, it's funny because obviously I wrote a memoir a few years ago about my childhood and about ending up in a psychiatric ward in New York. And everyone kept saying to me, what about when your son's old enough to read it? I was like, I wasn't planning on keeping any of this a secret from him.
Yeah.
Maybe wait until he's a bit older than three. But he did, it was lying on the bedroom floor the other day. So I was working on something and he pointed at the cover and went, "Mummy!" And I went, "Yeah." And then he pointed to pick it up and I was like, "No, maybe not quite yet." And went and like put it on a high shelf. It was like, maybe we'll wait a few years.
My kids, I mean, they literally grew up when they were the age of your son now, watching my brother go through terrible psychotic episodes, being a heroin addict, you know. There's no point hiding any of that shit from them. Like, you know, hide, you know, protect them from the things that will harm them.
Yeah.
But secrets are incredibly harmful.
Yeah.
When I wrote about having an abortion, somebody said, "Oh, you know, your children might read this." And I was like, "That, so?" And it turns out, like, now when they have to have debates in, like, RE about abortion, they get really fiercely, like, pro. So that's charming of them. But, like, you know, they are living in the same world that we live in, so
yeah.
I think it's best to be honest with them throughout. I'd like my children to be slightly less honest with me. I feel like teenagers used to hide a lot more things.
I was like the most square teenager ever, because they always say you rebel against
parents. The type, yeah.
So my rebellion was to be like super bookish, like I was head girl at school. I was a monitor. I was like one of those irritating like 6-year-old monitors with my little badge on in the corridor, bossing around all the other kids. I remember my mum once, I gave her some back chat and she said, "I'd ground you, but you never go anywhere and you haven't got any mates." And I was like,
"Oh, that is harsh."
True.
"I'd ground you, but you haven't got any mates." That's the kind of thing my sons say to each other. That was. So how would you sign off a letter to lovely Emily?
You're
not named after Emily Hughes.
Yeah. "Dear Emily, not Emily Hughes, breaking the cycle with you is the greatest achievement of my life. Love, Mummy."
Oh, that is, I mean, and he will definitely one day know it. Not yet.
No.
Not yet. So the second letter I asked you to write was to somebody who's no longer with us. So who would that letter be to?
Well, it is somebody who's no longer with us, but perhaps for different reasons.
Yeah, they don't have to be dead.
Yeah, she's not dead. Well, kind of. It's young Terry.
Oh,
I'm
young
just
you.
Refer to myself in the third person.
Like all good mad people.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly. I did used to refer, and specifically Terry around 6 or 7. And I did used to refer to her as, I'm definitely going full into it now, I used to refer to her as like a different person. So I kind of carved my life into two parts, which was until I left home and then everything after. And I used to say that I was a completely different person and this person had nothing to do with that person. And, you know, I've been making this documentary for radio, for the BBC, all around. It was actually off the back of Arthur Lobinio Hughes's death and around the statistics around what they call awfully ghost children, but the children who disappeared from school. And part of the reason I really wanted to do it was because, you know, school was a real place of safety
for
me.
You,
And I'd have been buggered without school, basically. And I just, you know, you worry about those kids who aren't in school, don't have that place of safety to go, don't have eyes on them outside of their own home. And, you know, a big part of that documentary was kind of digging back into my own past. Mm. So I went and visited my teacher. I got my social services records for the first time. and kind of.
And did they allow you to look at them properly? You are allowed to in nowadays.
Everything. But... I mean, pretty much 95% of it was redacted, which was frustrating. Including the one that most got my goat was the. I understand people's privacy, even though I think if you've abused a child, maybe your right to privacy shouldn't be
at the window.
Paramount.
See you later.
But the one that got me the most was, this is redacted because it could impact your mental health. Because
was
written was
you
so,
don't fucking
yeah.
say.
And I was like, it happened to me and you now won't let me read the thing about what happened to me because it might impact my mental health.
I had an amazing case once where we tried to get the records of a man who'd murdered his wife, and his daughter was my constituent. And the records about her death had been kept from them. And she was about 3 years old at the time. And then when we got them, the police account and the social services account of the night was about this little three-year-old girl walking through the blood of her mother. Mm. And she'd really wanted the records. And they said something similar to her. And she was like, I'm an adult woman now. This was in 1962 or something. Like, let me be the judge of this. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And all of that process was about... in some ways, like, trying to... I can't do anything about what happened to me as a kid. I can't go back and change that. But, going back there and kind of... and seeing what I can kind of put together about what happened then, it'll hopefully enable me to do stuff that'll save the next, 6-7-year-old who is where I was.
And Arthur Limbarjo Hughes, I mean, he was from the neighbouring constituency to mine... it's just absolutely harrowing. But all of those cases.
Yeah, I mean,
and they're happening all the time.
Well, yeah, my producer was gobsmacked that it's, there's one child a week.
Yeah.
Who dies. And it's he's like, oh, is that stat definitely right? Because I've never heard it before. And I'm like, that's. So the big cases we hear about, Star Hobson and Arthur. Yeah. It's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I read out the names of the dead women, because you only ever, like Sarah Everard, you know her name. But actually it's so common that the commonality of is the thing that we need to be fighting against.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty grim.
It is. But, kind of going back and I suppose...
Did you ever think you were going to die?
Yeah.
When you were a kid?
Yeah. Yeah. And there was one, the guy who we went to the refuge to get away from, he was incredibly violent, and he strangled my mum at one point because she refused to have a baby with him. And he was incredibly violent, and I thought he could definitely... I remember the day we left and he'd threatened my mum that morning because he didn't have any clean socks or pants. I can't remember which one. And he went mad and he said,
seems about, rational.
Exactly.
Yeah, rational reason to be incredibly violent.
And he stood at the door.
In your own fucking socks.
And he stood at the door, and I remember him saying to my mum, if this isn't sorted by the time I come home, you're going to get some fist. Mm. And off he went to work. And I don't know why that morning, because, he'd broken her nose, her fingers, her ribs, and she said, right, pack a bag, we're going. And we were like, no, I don't think we believed her. And we chucked some stuff in a bag and we went to the bus stop because we were going to Citizens Advice. Because, again, we didn't really... Back in the 80s, where'd you go for help? So I could go to the police, was it? And I remember sitting at the bus stop and we'd all got a bag each and just waiting, because it was like an hour, waiting for the bus to come down the hill and keeping my eye on the road that his car would come up from work if he came back. And I got it into my head that he knew we were going to run away and he was coming to get us. And that wait for the bus was the most terrifying, thing ever.
Because it would have been worse. The point at which the point at which you escape is the most dangerous
Which is the most dangerous. And you know it. I didn't know
that's
that.
That's why people don't do it. Yeah. But you don't know it intellectually or the statistics.
Yeah.
But you know that if you break the control, they will lose control.
Yeah. And
that means death in lots of cases.
And that was, that was terrifying. And even after we went home and he'd left the house, I was still very alert to the fact he could come back. He could, And that girl who was that terrified, that's the kind of...
Does that feel like somebody different to you?
Yeah. But part of actually writing the memoir and having my son and making this documentary, I think it's all part of the same thing for me, which is reconciling those two parts of myself and, you know, kind of not leaving little me out in the cold, saying, you know, oh, that happened to somebody else. But kind of, you know, because I do have an urge to, like, reach back through time and just say it's going to be all right. I know you're, like, scared out of your mind right now. And I know you think this is always going to be like this, but it's not. Like, it definitely isn't. Because when that's your only frame of experience, how do you see another reality where it's not chaos and it's not trauma and it's not fear?
It can only be what you can see.
Yeah.
If that's what you've always lived with, that's what you think is normal. Yeah, like just wanting to give yourself a cuddle and just be like, it'll be all right.
Yeah.
Oh, love, it'll be all right.
I can't... It's like I've got very few pictures of myself as a kid and I can't... I find it really hard to look at them because I can see how scared I look.
And did anybody ever say that to you? Did anyone ever give you a cuddle and say, you know what, it's going to be all right?
No, and there's no... It's funny.
That is, you know, like now I like to think somebody would. Well, but with Arthur, they didn't, did they? Although his nan tried, didn't
she? Yeah, she did. And he's, you know, he had... And that was the thing, he had family around
him.
He loved him. His auntie loved him. Like, he had lots of love in his life. But, you know, he was isolated from that love. And that was all about control as well.
That's
and
first rule, isolate. You can't abuse someone if you can't isolate them.
Yeah.
So how would you sign off a letter to little Terry?
So I'd say, you'll be OK. I know you feel like you can't live in the world right now, but you will. You'll learn how to live and you'll learn how to love. Hang in there. Love, Terry.
I just want to give her a cuddle.
I know, so do I.
Just want to give her a cuddle and just say, it'll be all right, Bab. I sit in my office with kids who come in with their mums trying to escape or just living in poverty or whatever that today's trauma is. I was just put my arm around them and say, it will be OK, you know. We'll make sure that it's OK.
Which you know, that the power in just saying that, because people may say, well, it'll be OK, what does that mean?
Yeah.
That's all a child wants. They want that reassurance.
I mean, I'm not going to sit there and be like, well, here's the bureaucracy to lay out to you. I mean, just like, they just want to hear someone give them a cuddle and say, you know, it's going to be all right. I know it doesn't feel like it, but it will be all right.
We'll be back for the final letter after a short break.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The last letter I asked you to think about was to somebody who would have no idea of the influence and power that they'd had in your life. So who would that be?
So this is my first boyfriend's mum.
Your first boyfriend's mum.
Yeah.
That is unusual. Don't think anyone's ever had their first boyfriend's mum before. So what was her name?
So her name was Pamela. And she used to call herself Pamela Mad Cow. I can't remember why. But we still message occasionally on Instagram and she signed it off once, Pamela Mad Cow.
Yeah.
Now suddenly 16 again.
I have to say, I think that people were considerably more self-depreciating than they are these days. And also, I was going to say,
politically correct. I hate this sort of terminology. But, yeah, my mum's pet name for my dad was Stupid Fat Fucker. But when people were around, she'd call him SFF. It's totally endearing.
That's love and kindness.
Yeah. Totally love and kindness. Totally. Pamela, why did she have such an influence on your life?
So I met her son when I was 16. Mm-hmm. And he was my first boyfriend. And we stayed together for 5 years, actually. Oh. Got engaged at 16. We had an engagement party above
a
pub.
Was it from Elizabeth Duke, your ring?
Well, it wasn't, actually.
Oh, my God, that's a step up, because the amount of girls who, like, shared the same engagement ring from the same boy from Elizabeth Duke, which was the Argos jeweller.
Cubic zirconia.
Yeah.
It was from it was 25 quid from a jeweller's just by the market in Chesterfield, which is where I'm from. I don't know what we were thinking, but we had a bottom drawer. We had a bottom drawer and everything. Like, people bought us towels, and I was going to university. I don't know what we thought we were doing, but she was, and they were very different to our family. So his mum and dad were both teachers. Yeah. They lived in a Barrett house.
Oh yeah, Barrett home. Yeah.
And I think they were actually the first proper middle class people I'd ever met.
Bet you by London standards they weren't middle class.
No.
They lived in a Barrett house.
They lived in a Barrett house. It was detached. I mean, they had like a Mondeo.
It wasn't until I was elected that I realised that middle class where I come from and middle class here is two different things.
Yeah. You see, to me, that's upper middle class down here. They don't know what they're on about.
Yeah.
But they had a Mondeo. A Mondeo.
Living the dream.
Honestly, two cars. So I'm sure when he met me, they were like, oh, fucking hell. Like, the girl from the bottom.
She's
literally
not from a Barrett home.
From the bottom of the hill, single mother, like. But they were so important to me at that time. So I was 16, I was preparing to go to university. Apart from my teachers, they were the first people I'd met who'd ever been to university. Because I was the first in my family to go. And they just opened this whole other world to me. So their house, I've got such memories of their house, and Radio 4 was, this is all cliches, but Radio 4 was always on, books on every shelves. They had a really brilliant knowledge of film and music. And they introduced me the summer, I vividly remember the summer before I went to university, and they let me like raid their bookshelves. And I read Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Michael Cunningham, Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath. And this like, it was like a light was switched on for me, that there was all of this other stuff in the world that I'd not really experienced before. And they were so kind and warm and treated me like a human being, treated me like an intellectual equal, and you know, painted this world for me that I could have if I left home and went to university. And it was such an important couple of years of my life, where I was becoming the person that I would end up being. And I don't know if she ever really knew how
important that was,
in shaping who I became.
Like, it becomes sort of slightly naff, hasn't it, to talk about kids who grow up with books in their house, but it is a thing.
It is.
And funnily enough, it's not necessarily just a class thing, although it does often fall on those lines.
Yes.
My husband was talking to me at the weekend about how his mum had got all the lids off, and he was born in socialising, lived in socialising all of his life, and his parents, like, if my children go to university, they will be the first in in his family to ever go to university, because that's not happened yet. But his mum had got all the smarty lids. Remember, they used to have the letters on them. And made, like, a thing with 26 packets of Benson and Hedges. And they all had the letters in, and they would do their spelling with them. And just having parents who, like, are fascinated by the world, whatever class they are, interested in the esoteric, and like, it just makes, and if you haven't had that and then you see it, it would be like, I don't know, like opening a door to a library, basically, I suppose, a library of inspiration. And if you'd never come across that,
And to another,
likelihood is that you wouldn't have ended up where you are.
And to a different life. I felt like I was stood on the precipice And they just opened the door and went, all of the, you can have access to all of this. It's not off limits to you. Mm. And you just need to go out and discover it. And they were curious, and they were intellectually curious, but also as human beings, and they just had such a warmth about them as well. When you were saying earlier about whether anyone ever gave me a hug, there was no physical affection in our house growing up. And I remember they were...
One of those families who could I'm from one of those families,
and
yeah.
I remember the first time I went to their house and his mum gave me a hug to say hello, and she used to always hug me to say hello and hug me to say goodbye, and I literally was like that, like... I don't know what to do. Somebody's touching me. Somebody's touching me. And I like completely spam me out. I'm like, who hugs like kids? What's going on? And then I loved it because I would go months without being touched at all. And you forget how important just being touched as a human being is. And so I just felt this real warmth and safety in their house. And, you know, when things were bad again at home, sometimes I'd go and stay there for a few days, and there was always, like, food on the table and, like, conversation, and it was just such a different experience than what I'd had at home.
Do you think you'll try and do this as you... So I grew up, funnily enough, in a house where we had lots of kids like you who ended up... staying with us. So kid whose mum had been killed by her dad came to live with us when we were kids, used to come on holiday with us in respite, and just people who, teenagers who couldn't, who, you know, for all sorts of reasons that I didn't really contemplate at the time, couldn't live, used to stay in our house. And definitely, my son is now 18, so my house has become this, like, the world is your oyster to these teenage, especially teenage girls.
Yep.
I'm like, being a cam girl is not a good idea. I know it seems like cheap money, but I'll tell you what, read this Toni Morrison.
Yeah, yeah.
I am like that with the teenagers who hang about my house. So with Emlyn's friends, you'll get to do this.
Oh, my God, I hope so. You know, and I want him to... when I was pregnant, I said to my boyfriend, what if he is, like, a cultural abyss and just ends up becoming an estate agent who, like, doesn't have any books in his house and never watches films? What are we going to do?
It doesn't happen, though, if they're your children. It doesn't happen.
I hope not. But so I'm, like, obsessed with him having access to whatever he wants, music, books, like, you know... watch Paddington 2, maybe don't watch Bing, like, trying to educate him.
I watched Poltergeist when I was 3 at my childminder's house. It was before the days of Ofsted.
Yeah.
Safeguarding. Yeah, definitely a safeguarding issue, God love that. It was the Women's Liberation Cooperative Childminding Service. Sort of like just, you know, very light touch. But they won't. Your kids won't be like that. You know, your son won't be like that. He will experience the whole world. And then they'll start lecturing you about it, like you don't know what you're talking about. Oh, my God, my son talks to me about film theory. I want to kill him. can't watch anything without him telling you about, oh, I don't know, male gaze and stuff like that.
Oh, no.
Please. It's very irritating, but also delightful that they have those opinions. So don't worry, it'll be fine. And you'll have a young Terry that turns up at your house one day.
Yeah.
And my children are like, oh, Mum's going to make a project of you if you come round.
I want a project.
You're going to get this chance, I'm telling you. So what would you say to Pamela Madcow? How would you sign off the letter?
So, Pamela Madcow, thank you for turning the light on, for showing me the world that I could inhabit. Love Terry.
Yeah. I mean, she probably doesn't know how important she was. Do you still talk to her son ever?
No. No.
I never talked to my boyfriend in 5 years from when I was 16 either. I bumped into him recently and he sort of was quite standoffish to me, and I thought, that's weird. Like, I was just like, oh, hello.
Well, and the truth was, when we split up, I was way more devastated about losing them than I was about losing him. Like, swear down. I was like...
I really liked my first boyfriend's mum. Yeah. I did not like his dad. I was glad to be rid.
Well, they were both brilliant and both so clever and just so... Oh, just brilliant company. And in my head, I had all the, like, years we'd spend together, all the Christmases we'd spend together, the holidays we'd go on together. And when we broke up, I was like, he took that from me. He took my future. And by future, future, I mean my future with his mum.
With Pamela Mascaro.
Yeah, he took away our rightful relationship.
Wow.
And we met up once. She still lives in Chesterfield, and we met up once for lunch when I was back from New York. And then she followed me on Instagram, and I was like so giddy. And now and now she likes the pictures of my son and stuff like that.
Lovely.
And
that's
I always
nice.
Think that could have been your grandson. But I don't know. I was just going to say, I didn't want to say that because it sounded weird, but now I've said it anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, Pamela Madcow, if I'm freaking you out, but it could be your grandson.
Well, thank you so much for coming, Terry. It's been a total pleasure to talk to you and little Terry, which sounds creepy when you say it like that, but we're trying to make
that's
it sound
so... That's like young Terry, yeah, but I'm not sure that's any better
young
either.
Young Terry.
Young Terry.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you click the follow button now on the app where you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. This has been an Audio Always original.